the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Legend has it that the great silent clown Buster Keaton, whose films are now considered masterpieces, never did anything worth seeing after 1928. But a book by my guest, James L. Niebuhr, tells a different story. Buster Keaton continued to do great work for the rest of his life, according to The Fall of Buster Keaton, his films for MGM, Educational Pictures, and Columbia. James Niebuhr, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
So the legend that Keaton made nothing of note after the advent of sound was largely perpetuated by Keaton himself.
Well, it's because Keaton was, by all intents and purposes, a creative genius. And his silent films, he got to be, he got to have the sort of absolute control that so many filmmakers just simply don't enjoy, especially during that era. Charlie Chaplin had it, Harold Lloyd had it, but they pretty much produced and owned their own pictures, whereas Buster Keaton worked for other producers, worked for other studios. And so with that sort of creative control, that sort of unlimited budget, he was able to come up with classics like The General or Steamboat Bill Jr., which required a lot of money to make his incredible, you know, technical ideas work. Well, once he left the independent filmmaking and went to the larger MGM studios, he didn't have that sort of creative control. It was much more of a business there. It was much more, you know, the product was basically the actors are hired to act. You're not to be directing. You're not to be contributing in other manners. And he felt creatively stifled. The films he made a lot of money. In fact, more money than his silent classics had made at the box office, which is a certain irony. But Keaton was unhappy, and for the rest of his life, he pretty much dismissed the work he did after the silent era simply because even when those films were good, they weren't his kind of good, and he just wasn't terribly pleased with the work he put out.
So you're saying that Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath made more money than The General?
As a matter of fact, it did.
And
really hurts to say that.
And yet it's completely, yeah, you know, except by you, it's virtually forgotten today.
Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath happens to no longer be under copyright. That's, I think, the only MGM film. No, there's two. Speak Easily also, I don't believe, is under copyright. So every low-rent VHS distributor was putting those out as, you know, the Buster Keaton classic, Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath for $2. So people would buy these things because The General, you know, in a nice restored print would cost like $8. And so they'd buy the $2 one and say, what's so funny about this guy? So
now, why is it that so many of his films are in the public domain?
Well, that's something that's kind of hard to gauge. It doesn't have as much to do with Buster Keaton as it does with the fact that a lot of times whatever bureaucracy just wasn't real accurate on copyright. And the way we discovered that these films were in the public domain was especially during, you know, the film collector circles, especially when VHS started to be widely available, it was discovered that some old movies just were not, you know, copyrighted by negligence or whatever other reason. And so you'd see certain films with people like Keaton or Laurel and Hardy or Charlie Chaplin or you know, the Three Stooges, and it would be those same films over and over again packaged together, and often it was not the best work by these people. So unfortunately, those who were not really into old movies but thought, well, let's see what a Laurel and Hardy movie looks like, let's see what a Charlie Chaplin movie looks like, might be grabbing something that isn't particularly good and not terribly representative of their work, and that's how they'd be judged. So it's just one of those business things that just sort of happened for some films.
You know, a lot of film fans love, people who love films, they have a feeling about the latter-day films of whoever. You know, the latter-day films of Laurel and Hardy, the latter-day films
right,
of Abbott and Costello, the latter-day films of the Three Stooges, that those films just aren't as good, which is where your book comes in. But are they all wrong? I mean, are there great... in addition to great Keaton films, are there great Laurel and Hardy films and Three Stooges films that people don't pay attention to? Are the Joe Besser Three Stooges worth watching?
Well, I think every artist has his or her peak period where they do what is, you know, basically their best work. In the case of Laurel and Hardy, they did do their best work for the Hal Roach Studios. When they left and went to the bigger 20th Century Fox and MGM and started making films there, they didn't have the same sort of creative control, and therefore the films, well, there were a lot of other factors. I mean, the boys were getting older by that time, and, you know, there were other factors involved, but to dismiss all of these films as simply these are bad, that's not... you know, that's not terribly open-minded, because Laurel did have some input in some of the later films, especially a movie like The Bullfighters from 1945. There's a couple of sequences in which Richard Lane, an actor who was in that movie, told me several years ago that Laurel was allowed to direct those pieces by the nominal director for Fox, Malcolm St. Clair. So those things do happen, but when they uniformly don't reach the level of the peak period of those comedians, there are film buffs who will say, well, that stuff's not as good, don't start there. Where, in fact, if a novice who has never seen Laurel and Hardy would watch a movie like The Bullfighters, they would probably lock into it as being a pretty funny movie, not maybe realizing that they have better films that were earlier, but that this one is perfectly competent. Unfortunately, in the case of some of the public domain stuff, it may very well be some of their worst work that might be available. And or in the case of Charlie Chaplin, a lot of the films were cut and, you know, duped and hard to watch and scenes in the wrong order. They were just kind of a mess, and nobody knew any better. They just slap them onto a videotape and say, Charlie Chaplin Festival. People will buy it and say, this guy's a genius, so it's better to get, you know, the better stuff from better distributors.
Well, in your book, The Fall of Buster Keaton, you talk about each of the things that Keaton has done after he came to MGM. You start with The Cameraman and Spite Marriage, which were two silents, and then you take us through everything he did. So if you were dipping in, whether you were a novice or a Buster Keaton fan, either way, what do you think these are the highlights of this post-silent era?
Well, actually, I remember once I was putting on a film program in town here where I live, and I asked Leonard Maltin what films he thought would be good as, you know, basic starting pieces, primers, for people who might not be terribly familiar with the work of each of the comedians. And for Buster Keaton, he said The Cameraman is a good place to start. And at that time, this is several years ago, decades ago, I wasn't familiar with that film. I knew it existed, but I had never seen it. So I took his advice, and the print they sent us was literally a silent print. There was no musical soundtrack with it. It was deadly silent in just the film. And it went over great, even under those conditions, with just a general audience that came to see it. So I always remember that particular incident as far as Keaton's post-independent work is concerned. The Cameraman is considered sort of the catalyst, where the old Keaton and the new Keaton are just kind of evolving into, and Keaton still had a reasonable amount of creative control. The problem at MGM was that after a while he was paired up with Jimmy Durante, and while Jimmy Durante is a delightful performer, his boisterous gusto is the very antithesis of the sort of comedy Keaton would do, and Buster Keaton seemed like a supporting player in his own starring vehicle because he was just this quiet guy on the sidelines who was following along with this big, noisy, you know, guy sucking the air out of every scene, and that got to be sort of a, you know, a bad balance. And when Keaton fans who are familiar with The General or who are familiar with The Navigator see that, they're like, what's this guy doing plummeting to the level of support for this other comedian when he's one of the great comic geniuses of cinema? However, if we back up and look at it objectively, we can see that Keaton is very cleverly performing at to the best of his skills and ability in films that were not particularly always suited for him, and often the results are pretty good. Keaton was still a skillful comedian. He was still a funny man. And if he might not have the absolute control, which was so unusual even back in the silent era, once he was working for the bigger studios, well, you know, that doesn't mean that it's all dismissive, that there was no skill involved. There was no, you know, Keaton is pretty much better than that. He wasn't that much at the mercy of the surrounding material.
We're talking with Jim Niebuhr, and he's the author of a great new book about Buster Keaton. It's called The Fall of Buster Keaton. So what about, now, one of the nice things about DVD is that pretty much everything is out there now, and we can see everything. I don't know. Do you think there's a lot of stuff we don't know about of Keaton's? Pretty much it's all out there.
Well, as far as the MGMs are concerned, there isn't a lot available on DVD. There's a package from Warner Home Video that contains The Two Silents, Cameraman and Spite Marriage, and his first talkie there, Free and Easy. And the public domain Parlor, Bedroom, and Bath and Speak Easily are here and there on different collections.
There's a Laserdisc box, right, a few years ago. There was a Laserdisc box.
There was a Laserdisc box, yeah, but nothing on DVD. You can't find, and there was on VHS, I believe, too, but on DVD you can't find, currently you can't find Doughboys or something like that, or Sidewalks of New York.
Right, but you can find all of these shorts and even some of his industrial work.
Yes, the short films he made after he left MGM, well, basically MGM pretty much were no longer interested in his services because Keaton had a lot of personal problems during this period, along with the fact that he felt creatively stifled, and he descended into alcoholism, which started showing up in his work. Ironically, the last film he made for MGM was called What? No Beer? And it was a rather dated comedy about Prohibition. And it's ironic that it was about Prohibition because during the entire filming, it was pretty obvious that Buster was on the bottle. His performance was, his timing was off, and essentially Durante appears to be carrying him when that shouldn't be necessary. When he left MGM, he had a shot at independent production again, but unfortunately that fell through for business reasons. And he ended up at a place called Educational Studios. And that was a low-budget place that did two real comedies, short 20-minute comedies. And there, Keaton had a little bit more creative control. His only problem there was the budgets were very severely limited. You know, something like The General, where he could have a train go across a bridge and have it collapse. I mean, you know, a very expensive shot. Well, I don't know that all of the films he made at Educational combined cost as much as that shot in The General. So being limited to such, you know, threadbare budgets, he had, you know, some creative limitation there. But otherwise, he was able to do some interesting things comedically, and some of the films he made at Educational were actually quite funny, and those are available in a package from a couple of different distributors, from Looser Than Loose and from Kino on Video. They're both of those distributors have released those. I think they might be in the public domain, but I don't know, so I don't want people to take my word for it and get arrested.
Well, name a title that you would say everybody should go find this particular Educational short. This is the top-notch one.
Of the Educational shorts, I think the first one he did, The Gold Ghost, is probably the best one, simply because there's long stretches where there isn't a lot of dialogue. It's mostly physical humor. And after MGM tried to everything from making him, you know, a drawing room comedian to a comedian who's trading, you know, dialogue with someone like Jimmy Durante, it's good to see Buster Keaton settling back into what is essentially pantomime and a throwback to what he did in silent pictures. And that makes The Gold Ghost sort of an interesting portent to the fact that Buster Keaton is going to be allowed to be funny at his own level again. So I think that's probably the one that I would recommend among the Educational films. There are other ones. Jailbait is funny. One Run Elmer is very funny. There are other ones that are quite good. That's the one I think I would recommend first.
And after a stint at Educational, he went to Columbia where the Three Stooges were making their shorts.
Yep, Columbia was run by Jules White, and the Three Stooges, which everybody is familiar with, are a very good example of the type of comedy that Jules White was interested in. Very slapsticky and violent and crude, but often very funny, even if only due to the absolute outrageousness. And there is a a certain art to something like the Three Stooges, because their timing was impeccable, and they created characters that have been enduring. And some of the quirks of someone like Curly is have entered the American lexicon, where every schoolboy who knows exactly what those things mean. So when Buster Keaton went there, it seems like something that boorish and over the top would be out of place for him, but I really think, and there are some people who completely dismiss the films he made there, I really think he did some of the best, his best sound movie work at that studio. I think his skills as a comedian settled in very nicely with that sort of crazy slapstick, and there were interesting, crazy characters for him to play off of. The scenes allowed for him to do some physical stuff that he was still capable of doing. And if he was unhappy, it didn't really show as much in his work. He never seemed, like, detached from the material. He seemed to be getting into it, and the performances are often very, very good. There's some good ones, and there's some weaker ones during his stint at Columbia. And he didn't stay very long, because in his later autobiography, he dismissed the short films as, crummy, I think was the adjective he used. There wasn't a lot of respect for short films during that time. The Three Stooges are extremely popular today, but at the time those films were being made in the theaters, they just had a general popularity, and certainly they didn't have a real lot of respect within the industry. And so, because short films were just like, well, those are only short movies, almost like amusing commercials would be today, within the industry, not the public. The public enjoyed them. So I think Buster Keaton dismissed them simply because it was, it was more slumming to him. It was lower than he had once been. He's a guy that started, creating some of the most incredible films ever, and then he started making films that weren't as good, that didn't give him a lot of creative control, but made a lot more money because they were for a bigger studio, and he had his troubles and was relegated to making low-budget films as he got older, and he probably had a different perspective being, within the eye of the storm than we do watching them, especially so many years later. So when we look at the Columbias now, especially being familiar with Jules White's brand of comedy and familiar with the Three Stooges, show them to an audience, and you'll see how well they go over. Buster Keaton is still a very funny man.
Again, give us a couple of titles. Which titles stand out?
Well, there's a lot of things that a lot of things he did at Columbia that were really interesting. The first one that comes to mind is a movie called Pest from the West. I think that's the very first film. I don't have the book in front of me, but yeah, from memory, that's the very first film he made for Columbia, and that wasn't directed by Jules White. And Buster Keaton is thriving within a setting that he's doing something that is a little bit more the style of comedy he had once done. It's very physical. There isn't a lot of dialogue, and he seems to be having fun with it. The actress who plays opposite with him, Lorna Gray, who was quite young when this film was made back in 1939, is still alive today. And when I did the book, I spoke to her, and she had fond memories of working with Buster Keaton, and she said there was no time during the production of that film where he ever felt, depressed or down, or was, felt like he was slumming or something like that. However, another actress who worked on a film with him a few films later, I talked to Jules White, it's got to be over 30 years ago, and there was a time, I believe the actress was Dorothy Appleby, who appeared with him a few times. There were times when, she saw him sitting off by himself crying, and she would ask Jules White, why is Buster crying? And Jules White says, well, he used to make $1,500 a week, and now he's in these short subjects for $500 a week. I don't know if I'm getting the figures right, but that's kind of where we're, the problem. He was once, a big star, and a lot of things happened to him, and now he's here. And maybe from that perspective, he could have been unhappy. He could have been concealing his unhappiness when he was working with Lorna Gray. But like I said, in retrospect, when we're approaching these films as films, there's funny stuff there. He's a skillful comedian, and I don't know that we should necessarily dismiss them out of hand because they're not at the level of something like The General. I mean, how many movies? Are there maybe three or four movies that are at that level in the history of American cinema? I don't know.
Well, and he was, as you point out in your book, you know, he was working, and he continued working all the way to the end of his life.
Right to the end, yes.
You just made me think of an interview that's in your book where you talked to an actress, and I can't remember who it was. Someone is in one of the beach party pictures, I think it was.
Irene Sue.
Yeah, and she didn't even know who he was, but later on she said, "Oh, I should have paid more attention. That was Buster Keaton."
Yeah, I talked to her. She was like the island girl in the movie How to Stuff a Wild Bikini. And I would have loved to have been at the board meeting that came up with that title. That's one of the American International Beach pictures. It was way at the end, you know, to the point where Frankie Avalon only has a cameo. It's Annette Funicello and Dwayne Hickman from the Dobie Gillis show carry this movie. And there's a few isolated scenes of Buster Keaton off on an island somewhere, and Irene Sue is in those scenes, and she said she grew up in China, and she wasn't familiar with who she was working with. She was just this, like, funny old man who was kind of grumbling to himself, and he didn't seem particularly happy. The director was very patient with him. His wife was there coaching him, and this was about a year before Buster Keaton passed away, so he probably wasn't in the best of health, so it was probably not the best time to be working opposite him. But she did have that experience, and it was good to locate her and get her information on it.
We're talking with James Niebuhr, and he's a film historian, and he's also written studies on the work of Jerry Lewis and Bob Hope and others. And, you know, the work of Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis are, I think, today kind of underestimated. Do you agree?
Well, I think Jerry Lewis is coming into his own more and more. There was a time when he was dismissed as just a bunch of funny faces, but and this whole ridiculous thing about only in France, the reason they say that is because French filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut championed his work. Mm-hmm. And everybody dismisses it as some great unwashed masses that are embracing this lowly comedy, when, in fact, Jerry Lewis is responsible for some consistently brilliant feature films during the 60s. And a lot of creative filmmaking ideas in those films. And when we did the Jerry Lewis book, I co-wrote that with Ted Okuda, another film historian out of Chicago. And when Ted and I wrote that book, unlike a lot of our other books, this comedian was still alive and well enough to be interviewed. So we set it up, and we were at Jerry Lewis's home, invited into his home, and allowed to interview him extensively, to the point where in our book, for each chapter on a film, we have Jerry Lewis's own opinion on that particular movie. So that's what sets our book apart from other studies on his work, is we have Jerry Lewis's assessment about the same film. Sometimes he agrees with us, sometimes not.
What film is Lewis's own personal favorite of his?
He always cites The Nutty Professor as his favorite for a lot of different reasons. And it is one of his best films, along with The Bellboy and The Patsy and The Ladies' Man. I think he likes the fact that, you know, playing the dual role and having the message of good versus evil and so forth, and the satire on the Jekyll Hyde scene. There's a lot of things about it that he particularly likes, and I think that's the one that he's always cited as his favorite.
And it's one of my favorites, too. But now, what about Bob Hope? I don't think Bob Hope is highly regarded these days.
Well, I think Bob Hope, it's probably because those of us who remember Bob Hope at all, I mean, the guy lived to be 100, and he stayed pretty active close to the end.
Yeah.
We remember Bob Hope, unfortunately, for a lot of the, you know, lousy TV specials he did towards the end.
He was just walking through them.
He's walking through them. He's reading off cue cards. The jokes aren't particularly funny. The laugh track is responding to him as if they were, and it was just kind of lame. And now that he's gone, he should be respected for his motion picture work, because that's when he was a funny guy. I mean, from about 1941 to about 1955 or so, just about every film he did was quite good, quite funny. He was not the creative person that a Buster Keaton or a Jerry Lewis were, because he was not a director, he was not a writer, but his personality, his brashness, his the way he worked with the material created for him. He knew what worked. He knew how many gags should be in this movie, and he would ask the writers, "You need to punch it up with a few jokes here." He had that sort of vision that was that made the films that much better. Classics in the technical sense, but they're very funny and very entertaining, and sometimes that's generally enough. And I think films like The Pale Face and Alias Jesse James and The Princess and the Pirate have held up quite well today.
I think you could argue that he understands his art as well as Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And not every great comedian is a director, right? I mean, I think Harry Langdon is a famous example. He was a great comedian when he was under the direction of Frank Capra, and then when he broke away from Capra, he never did anything good again.
Interesting enough, that's the subject for my next book. I'm going to do something on the Harry Langdon silence. And unfortunately, Frank Capra, when Capra was fired by Langdon, he had a certain bitterness, and he kind of let everybody know, hey, Langdon's difficult, and he got that reputation. And then he wrote in his autobiography that Langdon was hopeless without him. Mm-hmm. And later studies have discovered that Harry Langdon had a lot more input into his work than he had been given credit for. And the last couple of films he directed, which are now available on DVD, they're not bad movies. They're actually quite good. Some might argue they're as good as his other features that were helmed by Capra. It's just that Harry Langdon was something of an acquired taste. He had a different pace, he had a different style, and it was very popular in the 20s. Then all of a sudden, the market pretty much got saturated. The stuff he did for Max Sennett Studios was being withheld from a release and then released a little bit later, and at the same time he was making films for First National, and there'd be like three or four Harry Langdon films playing all at once, and it got to be maybe a little too much, whereas, you know, Chaplin was making a film, you know, every year or something like that by
right,
now.
Right.
Or maybe every few years, where Harry Langdon, there seemed to be a lot of him to go around, and people, I think, just simply kind of got tired of his style. Now, in retrospect, years later, we can look at the films, and there's a lot of brilliant ideas in the Harry Langdon films. He was, you know, an incredibly great comedian. But back then, I think the public just kind of got tired of him, and he worked hard to regain that, and I think the factors were against him. But that's the book I'm researching now to write next, and that's going to be an interesting thing as I go through the films, film by film, to discover just what's the problem, why isn't this working, and we'll see.
Well, so, James Nyberg, will you come back and discuss that when your Harry Langdon book is ready? Will you join us here on From the Bookshelf?
Oh, absolutely. I have a couple others in the hopper. I have the Stan Laurel silent films, Stan Without Ollie, looking at the Stan Laurel silent films, once again with Ted Okuda. And Scarecrow Press, who published my Fall of Buster Keaton book, I just sent them Chaplin at Keystone.
Enjoyed this book very much, and the book is called The Fall of Buster Keaton, His Films for MGM, Educational Pictures, and Columbia, and the author, my guest, James L. Nyberg. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Okay, thanks for having me, Gary.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank my guest, James Nyberg, author of The Fall of Buster Keaton, for joining us this week. The production of From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.